Chapter 9. Dagonet. Assumption. Falling. The orbits above Dagonet were clogged with the wreckage of ships that had tried too hard to make it off the surface. Vessels that were built as pleasure yachts or shuttlecraft, suborbitals and single-stage cargo barges for the runs to the near moons. Many of them had fallen foul of the system frigates, blockading the escape vectors, torn apart under hails of lasfire, but more had simply failed. Ships that were overloaded or ill-prepared for the rigors of leaving near-orbit space had burned out their drives or lost atmosphere. The sky was filled with iron coffins that were gradually spiraling back to the turning world below them. At night, those on the planet could see them coming home in streaks of fire, and they served as a reminder of what would happen to anyone who disagreed with the governor's new order. The Ultio navigated in on puffs of thruster gas, having left the warp in the shadow of the Dagonet system's thick asteroid belt. Cloaked in stealth technologies so advanced they were almost impenetrable, it easily avoided the ponderous turncoat cruisers and their nervous crews, finding safe harbor inside the empty shell of an abandoned orbital solar station. Securing the drive section in a place where it, along with Ultio's astropath and navigator, would be relatively safe, the forward module detached and reconfigured itself to resemble a common courier or gun cutter. The pilot's brain drew information from scans of the traitorous ships to alter the electropigments of the hull, and by the time the assassin craft touched down at the capital starport, it wore the same blue and green as the local forces, even down to the crudely crossed-out imperial aquila displayed by the defectors. Kell had coins stand by the vox rig, ready to talk back to the control tower. The Calidus had already listened in on comm traffic, snared from the airwaves by Tariel's complex scanning gear, and could perform a passable imitation of a Dagonetti accent. But challenge never came. The tower was gone, blown into broken fragments, and all across the sprawling landing fields and smoke-wreathed hangars, small fires were burning and wrecked ships that had died on takeoff lay atop crumpled departure terminals and support buildings. Gunfire and the thump of grenade detonations echoed to them across the open runways. Kell advanced down the ramp and used the sights of his new long rifle to sweep the perimeter.
"Fighting was recent," said the Garantine, following him down.
The hulking rage killer took a deep draught of air.
"Still smell the blood and cordite."
"We've moved on," said the sniper, sweeping his gaze over corpses of soldiers and civilians who lay where they had fallen.
It was difficult to be sure who had been shooting at who. Dagonet was in the middle of a civil war, and the lines of loyalist and turncoat were not yet clear to the new arrivals. A blink of laser fire from inside one of the massive terminals caught his eye, and he turned to it as the crack of broken air reached them a moment later.
"But not too far. They're fighting through the buildings. Lucky for us, the place is still contested. Leaves us with less explaining to do."
He shouldered the rifle as Tariel ventured a few wary steps down the ramp.
"Vindicare, how are we to proceed?"
Kell walked back up a way. The rest of the execution force were gathered on the lower deck, watching him intently.
"We need to gather intelligence, find out what's going on here."
"Dagonet's extrasolar communications went dark some time ago," noted Tariel. "Perhaps if you could secure a prisoner for interrogation."
Kell nodded and beckoned to Coin.
"Calidus, you're in charge until we get back."
"We?"
said Solm pointedly. He nodded towards the Garantine.
"The two of us. We'll scout the starport, see what we can find." "Ah, good,"
said the Eversaur, rubbing his clawed hands together.
"Exercise."
"Are you sure two will be enough?"
Solm went on. Kell ignored her and moved closer to Coin.
"Keep them alive, understand?"
Coin made a thoughtful face. "We're all lone wolves, Vindicari.
If the enemy come knocking, my first instinct may be to run and leave them.
He didn't rise to the bait.
Then consider that order a test of your oath over your instincts.
Sabrat's long coat swirled as the horror coiled, leaping into the air towards Hissos. The operative heard it snapping like sailcloth in a stiff breeze and recoiled, firing shots that should have struck center mass, but instead hit nothing but air. The thing that called itself spear landed close to him, and he took a heavy blow that threw him off his feet. Hissos slammed into a tall pile of Balthazar bottles that tumbled away with the impact, rolling this way and that. Pain raced up his spine as he twisted and tried to regain his footing. Spear tossed the coat away, and then, with care that seemed strange for something so abhorrent in appearance, deftly unbuttoned the white shirt beneath and set it aside. Bare from the waist up, Hissos could see that the creature's flesh was writhing and changing, cherry red like tanned leather. He saw what looked like hands pressing out from inside the cage of the monster's chest, and the profile of a screaming face. Yosef Sabrat's face. The bare arms distended and grew large, their proportions ballooning. Fingers merged into flat mittens of meat, grew stiff and glassy. Hands became bone blades, pennants of pinkish-black nerve tissue dangling from them. Hissos aimed the gun and fired at the place where a man's heart would have been. But down came the arms and the shot was deflected away. He smelled a slaughterhouse stink coming off the creature, saw the sizzling pit in the limb from the impact as it filled with ooze and knit itself shut. The body of the thing was in chaos. It writhed and throbbed and pulsed in disgusting ways, and the operative was struck by the conviction that something was inside the meat of it, trying to get out. As the eyeless face glared into him, the distended jaws opening wide to let droplets of spittle fall free, Hissos found his voice.
You killed them all.
Yes.
The reply was a gurgling chug of noise.
Why?
He demanded, retreating back until he was trapped against the fallen bottles.
What in terror's name are you?
It's no terror.
It bubbled, horrible amusement shading the words.
Only terror!
Hissos saw the shape of the face again, this time pressing from the meat of Spear's bloated shoulders. He was sure it was crying out to him, imploring him, run, it mouthed. Run, 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 run! He raised the gun, shaking, his blood turning to ice, hands tightening on the grip, aiming for the head. In his time, Hissos had seen many things that defied easy explanation. Strange forms of alien life, the impossible vistas of warp space, the darkest potentials of the human character. And this creature was first among them. If hell was a place, then this was something that had been torn out of that infernal realm and thrust into the real world. Spear raised its sword arms and rattled their hard surfaces off one another.
One more,
it intoned.
One step closer.
To what? The question was a gasp. It came at him again, and Hissos shot it in the face. Spear shrugged it off. The first downward slash cut away Hissos's right hand across the forearm, the gun falling with it. The second stabbing motion pierced skin, ribcage, and lung before emerging from his back in a splatter of dark arterial crimson. Hissos was not quite dead as Spear began to cut him into pieces. His last awareness was of the sound of his own flesh being eaten. Shots and cries of pain sounded distantly as they drew closer to the engagement. The crackling drone of an emplaced autocannon sounded every few moments from down in the open plaza. They had found plenty of dead along the way, and to begin with, the Eversaw paused at the sight of each clash, looking around to see if any of the combatants had perished carrying weapons of any particular note. But he found nothing he wanted to salvage, all of it basic Naya-pattern stubbers and the occasional lasgun. The Garantine didn't like lasers. Too fragile, too lightweight, too prone to malfunction when worked hard. He liked the heavy certainty of a ballistic gun, the comforting shock of recoil when it fired, the deep bass note of the shells crashing from the muzzle or the wickering sizzle of needle rounds. The bulky combi weapon in his mailed fist was a perfect fit. It was his intention, rendered in gunmetal. Crouching in the lee of a tall, broken terracotta urn, he studied the executor pistol and worked his fingers around the grip. The desire to use it on some target, any target, was almost too much to hold in. The anticipation tingled in his lobochips, and he felt the chemo glands in his neck grow cold as they produced a calmative to regulate the hammering pace of his heartbeat.
Ever so.
The sniper's voice issued from the earpiece of his skull mask.
There's a group of irregulars to the south under the broken chronograph near the monorail entrance. They're dug in with a heavy gun.
The Garantine took a look around the urn and saw the shattered clock face. He grunted an affirmative and Kel went on.
They're holding off a unit of Defense Force troopers. Not many of the PDFs left. Hold and observe.
That last sentence actually drew a laugh from the Eversaw.
Oh, no!
He jumped to his feet, the hissing of stimjectors sounding in his ears, and rolling fire flooded through him. The Garantine's eyes widened behind his mask, and his body resonated like a struck chord. Kel was saying something over the vox, but it seemed like the chattering of an insect. The Garantine leapt into the air from the balcony overlooking the ticketing plaza and fell two stories to land on the top of the smashed clock, where it hung from spars extending from the ceiling. The weight of his arrival dislodged the whole construction, and he dropped with it, riding it to the tiled floor below to land behind the makeshift gun emplacement. The clock exploded into fragments as it struck the ground, ejecting cogwheels and bits of the fascia in all directions, the shock of it staggering the men behind the autocannon. Kel had called them irregulars. That meant they were not soldiers, at least in an official sense. His drug-sharpened perception took in all details of them at once. They were garbed in pieces of armour, some of it PDF or Arbites issue, and the weapons they carried were an equally random assortment. At the sight of the towering skull-masked monster that had fallen from the skies above them, the men on the autocannon hauled the weapon around on its tripod, swinging it to bear on the Garantine. He roared and threw himself at them, his shout lost in the scream of the executor. Bolt shells broke the bodies of the men in wet red bursts, and he fell into their line, raking others with the spines of his neuro-gauntlet. The barbs of the glove bit into flesh and sent those it touched reeling to a twitching, frenzied death. Those on the autocannon he killed by punching, putting his fist through their ribcages. As an afterthought, he kicked the tripod gun away, and it rolled to the tiled floor. Shivering with the rush, he laughed again. Through his adrenaline haze, he saw the men in the PDF uniforms warily peer out of cover, and then finally advance towards him with laser carbines ready. He gave a theatrical bow and addressed them.
"A rescue," he snapped. "Consider it a gift from the ruler of Terror."
"Idiot,"
Kel's words pierced the veil of his racing thoughts.
"Look at their chest plates."
He did so. All of the PDF soldiers wore the etched outer quilla that signified their rejection of the Emperor's dominion. They started firing, and the Garantine laughed once more, diving into the beam salvo with the executor at his lead. Spear's meal was methodical. All the eating of the human foodstuffs while it had been in quietus had been enough to fuel the camouflage aspect's biology, but the layers of the killer's true self were starting to starve. Sipping at the meat of the dock worker and the clerk had served to hold off the hunger pangs, but they had not been enough for true satisfaction, and the destruction of the telepath had taken a lot of energy from him. Still, feeding now and a full meal with it, bones ground between razor teeth, organs still hot and wet, bitten into like ripe fruits, and blood by the bucket for the drinking. Thirst slaked for a while.
Yes.
It would do. Deep in the canyons of his mind, Spear could hear the echo of the camouflage's ghost mind as it wept and screamed, forced to watch these deeds from the cage where it was held. It could not understand that it was only noise now, no longer a being with life and power to influence the outside world. For as long as Spear remained in control, it would always be so. Yosef Sabrat was only the last in a long line of coatings painted over Spear's malleable aspect, like a dye poured on silk. The killer's flesh, infused with the living skin of a warp predator, was more demon than man, and it obeyed no laws of the conventional universe. It was a shape with no shape, but not like those human fools who used chemical filters to manipulate their skin and bone and think themselves clever. What Spear was went beyond the nature of disguise, beyond transformation. There was a word for it that the ancient man theologies used to talk of their deities taking on human form. They called it assumption. When he was sated, he gathered what remained of Hissos and cautiously filled a barrel with the leavings. The operative's clothing and gear he had stripped with care, placing it to one side for later use. The corpse meat would be hurled from the roof of the wine stock, where it would fall to the floor of the narrow crags far below and into the rapids that would wash the leftovers out to sea. But first, he had the final steps to perform. From one of the giant tanks given over to the maturation of the wines, Spear dragged out a fleshy egg and used his teeth to open it. Foul gases discharged from within, and a naked man dropped out onto the wooden flooring. The sack had grown from a seed Spear planted in the lung of a homeless drunkard shortly after arriving on Iesta Veracrux. Conjured by the sorcery of his masters, the seed consumed the vagrant to make the egg, giving birth to a stasis call where Spear had been able to store Yosef Sabrat's body for the past 2 months. As the sack dissolved into vapour, he dressed Sabrat in the clothes he had worn while the aspect had been at the fore. The call had done its work. The dead Reeve looked as if he had been freshly killed. No human means of detection would say otherwise. The stab wound through the man's heart began to bleed again, and Spear artfully arranged the body, finding the harvesting knife in a flesh pocket and applying it to the wound. He paused to ensure that the puncture on the roof of Sabrat's mouth was not visible. The iron-hard proboscis that penetrated there had licked at the matter of the lawman's brain and siphoned off the chains of chemicals that were his memories, his persona. Then, Spear's demon skin had patterned itself on those markers, shifting and becoming. The change was so strong, so deep, that when Spear surrendered control to it, the camouflage aspect was not merely a mask that the murderer wore. It was a living, breathing identity. A persona so perfect that it believed itself to be real, resilient enough that even a cursory psionic scan would not see the lie of it. Still, it had made sense to murder the Psycho Woman as soon as possible, if not only to protect the truth, but also to force the hand of the investigators. Now the next phase was complete, and the Yosef Sabrat identity had played its role flawlessly. Soon, Spear would begin the purgation of the disguise and finally be rid of the man's irritatingly moral thought processes, his disgustingly soft compassion, the sickening attachment to his colleagues, brood child and bed partner. From this point on, Spear would only wear a face and never again give himself over to another man's self. He was almost giddy with anticipation. Just a few more steps, and he would be within striking distance of his target. The murderer knelt next to Hissos's head, severed at the neck by a slicing cut, and gathered it up.
With a guttural choke, Spear spat the proboscis from the soft palate of his mouth and into the skull through its right eye. Seeking, penetrating, it dug deep and found the regions of the dead man's brain where his self was growing cold. Spear drank him in.
Coin put away the monocular and hid it inside the pocket of the officer's tunic the infocyte had recovered from one of the airfield's dead. It fit snugly, but the adjustment of the fluid-filled morphing bladders layered underneath the Calidus's skin allowed the assassin to alter body mass and dimension to accommodate it a little better.
"How do you propose we get inside?" said Iota.
The Culexus was almost invisible in the shadows by the broken window, with only the steel-grey curve of her grinning helmet visible in the moonlight. Her voice had a peculiar metallic timbre to it when she spoke from inside the psycho-hood, as if it were coming to Coin's ears from a very great distance.
"Through the front door."
The Calidus watched the men walking back and forth in front of the communicatory, considering the cautious motions in their steps, analysing the cues of their body language, not just for infiltration's sake, but to pass their states of mind. Data slates, recovered from what remained of the corpses of the turncoat patrol murdered by the Garantine, had provided the execution force with a lead on this facility. It was the nearest thing to a garrison for kilometres around, and at this stage, Kel wasn't ready to send the group out from the relative safety of the Ultio and down the long highway to the capital city several kilometres to the south. The metropolis itself, the largest of all on Dagonet, could be seen clearly against the darkening sky. Some of the taller towers were still smoking. Some had half collapsed and fallen like drunkards suspended on each other's shoulders. But no snakes of tracer lashed at the skies. There were no mushroom clouds or flights of assault craft buzzing overhead. It seemed calm, or at least as calm as a city on a world at war with itself had any right to be. When Coin had asked the Vindicare what he had learned on his scouting mission, the Eversaw had just grinned, and the sniper replied with a terse dismissal.
"It's complicated," he said.
Coin did not doubt that. The Calidus had learned through many hundreds of field operations, a lot of them in active zones of conflict, that what generals in their places of comfort and control called ground truth was often anything but true. For the soldier, as much as the assassin, the only equation of truth that always worked was the simple vector between a weapon and a target. But now they were here, Coin and the pariah girl Iota, the Culexus's skin-crawling null ability brought along to protect the Shade from any possible psionic interception.
"Tariel was correct in his evaluation," said Iota, as a rotoplane chattered past overhead. "There is an astropath inside that building."
"Is it aware of you?"
She shook her head, the distended skull helm moving back and forth.
"No. I think it may be under the influence of chemical restraints."
"Good."
Coin stood up.
"We don't want the alarm to be raised before we are done here."
Concentrating on a thought shape and impressing that on flesh, the Calidus altered the dimensions of its vocal cords, mimicking the tonality of an officer caught on one of the intercepted Vox broadcasts.
"We will proceed."
The shapeshifter was as good as its word. Keeping to the shadows and the low rooftops along the starport's blockhouses, Iota followed the Calidus and watched Coin become a simulacrum of a turncoat PDF commander, advancing through the outer guard post of the communicatory without raising even a moment of concern. At one point, Iota lost sight of the Calidus, and when a man in Dagonetti colours approached her hiding place, she made ready the combi needler about the wrist of her killing hand in order to silently end him.
"Iota,"
called an entirely different voice.
"Show yourself."
She stepped into the light.
"I like your tricks," said Iota.
Coin smiled with someone else's face and opened a door.
"This way. I will leave the guards at the elevator in here, so we won't have much time. They're holding the astropath in one of the sublevels."
"Why did you change it?"
Iota asked as they moved through the ill-lit corridors.
The face.
I bore easily, replied Coyne, halting at a lift shaft. Here we are.
As the Calidus reached for the switch, the doors opened, flooding the corridor with light. Inside the elevator, two troopers saw the dark shape of the Culexus and went for their guns. Spear swallowed Hissos's one undamaged eye before depositing the dead man's reamed head among the rest of him. And then, with a swift spin of his body, he pitched the remains into the canyon and watched them fall away. Returning to the tank room, he skirted the beauty of the blood art he had made from Erno Sig's corpse. He had used poor Erno as his stalking horse, tormenting him, pushing him to the edge of sanity before destroying him. The man had served his purpose perfectly. Spear moved on, checking once more that the body of Yosef Sabrat had been arranged just so. The evidence he had fabricated over the past few weeks was also scattered around, arranged so that when it was discovered, it would lead the investigators of the Centine towards one undeniable conclusion. The killer of Yared Nota, Kirsten Lateeg, Perrig, and Sig, and the rest of them, was none other than their fellow lawman. He made a mock solemn expression with the new face he wore, trying the look on for size, but he had no mirror to see how it seemed on his new guise. Spear pawed at a face that now resembled that of the Eurotas operative. It felt odd and incomplete. The churn of new memories and personalities sucked in from Hissos was curdling where it mixed with those of Sabrat, making him thought-sick. It seemed it would be necessary to purge the stolid Reeve's self sooner rather than later. With a deep sigh, Spear dropped to the floor and sat cross-legged. He drew on the disciplines that had been beaten into him by his master and focused his will, seeing it like a line of poison fire laced with ink-black ice. Reaching into the depths of his thoughts, Spear found the cage and tore it open, clawing inside to gather up the mind scraps that were all that remained of Yosef Sabrat. He grinned as fear resonated up from the shuddering persona, as some understanding of its final end became clear. Then he began the purge, ripping and tearing, destroying everything that had been the man, vomiting up every nauseating, cloying skein of emotion, little by little sluicing Sabrat's cloying self away. Spear gave this deed such focus that it was only when he heard the voice he realized he was no longer alone. Coyne's hand flicked up, and the toxin-filled stiletto hidden in a wrist sheath flew out in a shallow arc, piercing the stomach of the man on the left. The liquid inside was a consumptive agent that feasted on organic matter, even down to natural fibers and cured leather. He fell to the floor and began to dissolve. The other man was briefly wreathed in white light that glowed down the hallway as Iota pressed a hand into his chest and shoved him back into the elevator. Coyne watched with detachment as the Culexus's dark power enveloped the man and destroyed him. His silent scream resonated, and he became a mass of material like burned paper. In moments, a curl of damp smoke was all that marked the man's passing. The other hapless soldier was now a puddle of fluids leaking away through the gridded decking of the elevator floor. Content that the toxin had run its course and consumed itself into the bargain, the Calidus kicked at the collection of inert tooth fillings, metal buttons and plastic buckles that had gathered and brushed them away with the passage of a boot. Coyne took a moment to break the bioloom bubble illuminating the interior of the elevator, and then pressed the control to send it downwards. They travelled in dark and silence for a few moments, and for Coyne, the Culexus seemed to melt away and disappear, even though she was standing at his shoulder.
His name was Morten Gautami, Iota said suddenly. He never told anyone of it, but his mother had been able to see the future in dreams. He had a measure of post-cognitive ability, but he indulged in narcotics, preventing him from accessing his potential.
The skullhead turned slightly.
I used that untapped energy to destroy him.
I'll bet you know the names of everyone you've terminated, said Coyne with a flicker of cruelty.
Don't you? Said the Culexus.
The Calidus didn't bother to grace that with an answer. The elevator arrived at the sublevel, and the guards standing outside fell to quick killing blows. There was a spherical containment chamber in the middle of a room made of ferrocrete, festoons of cables issuing from every point on its surface. A heavy iron iris hatch lay facing them like a closed eye, a short gantry reaching it from the sublevel proper. Coyne stepped up and worked the lever to open it. There was a thin, high-pitched sound coming from inside, and at first the Calidus thought it was a pressure leak. Then the iron leaves retracted, and it became clear it was reedy, shrill, screaming. Coyne peered into the depths and saw the corpse grey astropath. It was pressed up against the back of the sphere's inner wall, glaring sightlessly towards Iota.
Owl mind,
it babbled between howls.
Black shroud, poison thought.
The Calidus wrapped a stolen pistol against the threshold of the hatch.
Hey, Coyne snarled in the officer's voice. Stop whining. I'll make this simple. Give up the information I need or I'll lock her in there with you.
The astropath made the sign of the Aquila, as if it were some kind of ancient rite of warding that would fend off evil. The shrieking died away, and crack-throated, the psychic spoke.
Just keep it at a distance.
Iota took her cue and wandered away, moving back towards the elevator shaft, but still within earshot.
Better?
That earned Coyne a weak nod.
I'll tell you what you want to know.
The assassin learned quickly that the astropath was one of only a handful of its kind still alive in the Dagonet system. In the headlong melee of revolution, in the process of isolating itself from the galaxy and the Imperium, the planet had begun to rid itself of all lines of connection back to Terra. But some of the newly empowered nobles had thought otherwise, and made sure that at least a few telepaths capable of interstellar sending were kept alive. This was one of them, cut off from all means of speaking to its kindred, locked up and isolated. It was starved of communication, and once it began to talk in its papery monotone, the astropath seemed unable to stop. The psychic spoke of the state of the Civil War. As the brief given by Captain General Valdor had said, Dagonet was a keystone world in the politico-economic structure of the Tabian sector, and if it fell fully under the shadow of the Warmaster, then it would mark the beginning of a domino effect, as planet after planet along the same trade axis followed suit. Every loyalist foothold in this sector of space would be in jeopardy. In the first moments of the insurrection, desperate signals had been sent to the Adeptus Astartes and the Imperial Navy, but these had gone unanswered. Coyne took this in and said nothing. Both the ships of the Admiralty and the legions of the Emperor's loyalist Astartes had battles of their own to fight, far from the Tabian stars. They would not intervene. For all the fire and destruction the collapse of Dagonet and its sister worlds might cause, there were larger conflicts being addressed at this very moment. No crusade of heroes was coming to ride to the rescue. Then the astropath began to lay out the lines of the Civil War as it had spread up until this point, and the Calidus thought back to something said aboard the Ultio on their way to Dagonet. The Civil War was a rout, and it was those who stood in the Emperor's name who were dying. Across the planet, the forces that carried Horus's banner were only days away from breaking the back of any resistance. Dagonet was already lost. Reeve Daig Segan. Through Sabrat's memories, Spear recalled that the man was as dogged as he was dour, and for all his apparently slow aspect, he was troublingly perceptive.
Yusuf,
said the Reeve, moving through the gloom with a torch in one hand and a gun in the other.
What is that stench? Yusuf! Hissos! Are you in there?
Segan had followed them to Whiteleaf, despite the orders Sabrat had given, the persona unaware of Spear's subtle guidance bubbling beneath the surface. In his thoughts, the murderer heard the dim resonance of Sabrat's essence crying out to be heard. Impossibly, the persona was trying to defy him. It was fighting its own erasure. Spear's body, cloaked in Hissos's proxy flesh, trembled. The purge was a complicated, delicate task that required all of his concentration. He could not afford to deal with any interruption, not now, not when he was at so critical a juncture.
Hello?
Segan was coming closer. At any moment, he would come across Spear's carefully constructed crime scene. But it was too soon. Too soon! Very clearly, Spear heard Sabrat laughing at him. With sudden annoyance, he punched himself in the head, and the pain of the blow made the ghost of the voice fall silent. His cheek and the orbit of his right eye sagged as they tried to retain the shape of Hissos's imprint. Spear got up and went to meet Segan as he approached. The other Reeve's torch caught him, and he heard the man gasp in shock.
Hissos? Where's Yusuf?
Segan peered at him.
What's wrong with your face?
Nothing, said the operative's voice. Everything is fine. The Reeve seemed doubtful.
Oh, can you smell that? It's like blood and shit and all kinds of...
Segan's torchlight illuminated part of the operative's coat, still wet with vitae.
Are you hurt?
Spear was close to him now.
I had a job for you, he said. A part to play. Why did you come here when I told you to stay in the city? Well, Yusuf told me to stay, not you,
Segan retorted, becoming wary.
I don't follow your orders, even if everyone else jumps each time your damn baron coughs. But you should have stayed,
Spear insisted.
Now I'll have to rewrite the scenario. What are you on about?
Said the Reeve.
Come and see.
Spear lashed out and grabbed him by the collar. Caught off guard, Segan stumbled, and that was all the murderer needed to destroy his balance and throw him down the length of the room. Segan slammed into the floor, his gun skittering away into the shadows, sliding to a halt at the edge of the blood pool. He reacted with a sharp yelp.
Thrown!
He saw Sabrat's body, and Spear felt a moment of victory as something perished inside the other man. A little bit of his will shriveled to see his friend so violated.
Yusuf. He did it all, said Spear. How terrible.
Segan shot a venomous glare in his direction.
Liar! Never! Yusuf Sabrat is a good man. He would never... never...
Spear frowned.
Yes, I knew you wouldn't accept it. That was your role. There had to be one person in the Centene who would fight this explanation, or else it would seem false. But now you've ruined that. I'll have to compensate.
At last, understanding dawned on the other man's face.
You. You did this. I did it all.
Spear chuckled. He let his face shift and transform, his eyes become black and dark.
I did it all,
he repeated. The blood drained from Segan's face as Spear came closer, letting the change happen slowly. With trembling fingers, the Reeve pulled something shiny and gold from inside his cuff and clung to it, as if it were the key to a door that would spirit him away from the horror all around him. The dour little man was pinned to the spot, transfixed with fright.
The Emperor protects, Segan said aloud. The Emperor protects.
Spear opened his spiked jaws.
He really doesn't, said the murderer.
The distant hum and crack of mortar shells could be heard on the Altio's flight deck through the opened vents in the canopy that let in wet, grimy air. Coyne's encrypted report, burst transmitted via tight-beam vox, had reached them just after sunset and confirmed Tariel's worst fears. The mission was over before it had even begun. He said as much to Kel and the others, earning himself a feral snarl from the Garantine.
Weakling,
growled the Eversaw.
You're gutless, afraid to get your robes dirty in the field.
The hulking killer leaned towards him, looming. He had his mask off, and his scarred, broken face was, if anything, more ugly than the metal skull.
Mission circumstances always change, but we adapt and burn through.
Burn through? Repeated the Vanus. Perhaps you misunderstood the meaning of Coyne's report. Did the larger words confuse you?
The Garantine rose to his feet, eyes narrowing.
Say that again, piss-streak. I dare you.
This war is over, Tariel almost shouted it. Dagonet is as good as conquered. Horus has won this world, don't you see?
Horus has not even set foot on Dagonet, countered Soam. He rounded on her.
Exactly. The War Master is not even here, and yet still he is here.
Make him speak sense, the Eversaw said to Kel, or I'll cut his tongue out.
It's not Horus, Kel explained. It's what he represents.
Tariel nodded sharply.
The turncoat nobility on this planet don't need to see Horus. His influence hangs over Dagonet like an eclipse blotting out the sun. They're fighting in his name in fear of him, and that is enough. And when they win, the War Master's work will be done for him. This same thing is happening all across the galaxy, on every world too far from the Emperor and the rule of Terra.
He trembled a little with the sudden frustration he felt deep inside him.
When Dagonet falls, Horus will turn his face from this place and move on, his advance one step closer to the gates of the Imperial Palace.
Horus will not come to Dagonet, said Soam, catching on. He will have no need to. The Infocyte nodded again.
And everything we prepared for, the whole purpose of this mission, will be worthless.
We'll lose our chance to kill him, said Kel.
I,
snapped Tariel, and he shot the Garantine in a glare.
Do you see now?
The Eversaw's expression shifted, and after a moment he nodded.
Then we must make sure he does come to Dagonet.
Soam folded her arms.
How do you propose to do that?
Once this planet's governor makes his allegiance known to the insurrectionists, perhaps the War Master may send some delegate to plant the flag, but no more than a starship admiral or some such. He won't waste a single space marine's time on matters of dispensation.
The Garantine grunted with callous humor.
You all think I'm the slow one here, don't you? But you miss the obvious answer, woman. If Horus won't come to a fight that has ended, then we make sure the fight does not end.
Deliberately prolong the civil war,
Kel said the words without weight.
We draw him to us, said the Eversaw,
warming to his theme, showing teeth.
We make the taking of Dagonet such a thorn in his side that he has no choice but to come here and deal with it himself.
Tariel considered the idea. It was blunt and crude, but it had merit, and it could work.
Dagonet has a personal resonance with the War Master. It was the site of one of his very first victories. That and its strategic value. It could be enough. It would be a dishonor for him to let this planet slip from his control.
Hearing footsteps across the deck, he glanced up to see Iota step onto the flight deck. Behind her was a man he did not recognize in a PDF uniform.
Relax, Vanus, said the man, in a cynical tone that could only be Coyne's. I take it you found my report to be compelling reading?
So,
what have we missed?
You exfiltrated without any complications, said Kel.
Iota nodded.
What is the local time? 14:49.
Tariel answered automatically. His chrono implant already synced to the Dagonet clock standard.
There's six of us, the Garantine went on. Each has destroyed rulers and broken kingdoms all on their own. How hard could it be to add some fuel to this little blaze?
And what about the Dagonetti? Soam demanded. They'll be caught in the crossfire.
The other assassin looked away, unconcerned.
Collateral damage.
What is the local time?
Iota said again.
14:50. Why do you keep asking?
Tariel's reply was cut off by a flash of light in the distance, followed seconds later by the report of an explosion.
"What in Hades was that?"
said Kel.
"The communicatory."
"A power generator overload. I made it look like the common of freedom fighters did it," said Coyne. "We couldn't afford to leave any traces, or survivors."
The Garantine's grin grew even wider.
"Ah, see? We've already started."